Hello, everyone. It's delightful to be here for our World Spirituality Based on Integral Principles series, which is now in its third conversation. We're doing conversations with Deepak Chopra, John Mackey, John Gray, Ken Wilber, who's, you know, key to the whole process, and many other leading thinkers in the world about the nature of what a world spirituality might be. And I am, like, wildly delighted today to host my good friend and colleague, Andrew Cohen, who is known to many of you, who's done really trailblazing work in unpacking the evolutionary vision over the last, you know, I would say 20, 25 years, but probably the last 10 years. Andrew, I think you've been kind of very, very deep in the evolutionary conversation.
That's right, yeah.
A kind of evolution, you know, evolving. Actually, I was having a dinner the other night, again, with my new big brother, Michael Murphy, and he was describing to me what he thought was just the difference. He had just done a dialogue with you, which he totally enjoyed, and he said, wow, Andrew wasn't an evolutionary 15 years ago. And he described the evolution of the evolutionary, and he was very excited about it, and send you lots of love and regards.
That's right. He was right.
Yeah. So I think our conversation today would be, and you and I have been talking about having this conversation for about a year and a half now, is what's the difference between, right, where do they share a language, and where are these two visions of a evolutionary spirituality and a world spirituality different? And maybe just I'll spend just a minute framing the question and turn it to you to start, if that feels right, which is as follows. Both the articulation of evolutionary spirituality as a worldview that people can live by, right, and the articulation of a world spirituality are very, very new, right? World spirituality is, of course, newer. I first used the term, you know, a year and a half ago at ISC. But even evolutionary spirituality, right, is profoundly new. You know, although we can trace it back, you know, to sources, you know, both in the proto sources in the great traditions, and then to Fichte, Schelling, Herder, you know, in that kind of German, you know, school that launched it into modernity. Nonetheless, right, you're teaching evolutionary spirituality as a lived worldview in a way very, very different than anything that Fichte or Schelling imagined, right? That I'm thinking about world spirituality not as a kind of abstract conversation, but as something that people can live by. And I think one of the things that we share is a concern not merely with kind of abstract academic formulations, but how do people actually live awake and alive and giving in a profound way in the world that's compelling when they're no longer living in the great traditions? I mean, that perhaps is a way to frame our shared conversation. And perhaps what we can try and do is outline what might be, you know, the basic, you know, touchstones, tenets, right, of an evolutionary spirituality, of a world spirituality, you know, and where do they differ and where do they share common language? Does that sound like a program?
That sounds very good. And I think, I think it would be helpful because I haven't really thought much about the whole question of world spirituality, probably since we had our last talk about it, maybe
right,
five or six months ago. And I know that you have been thinking quite a lot about it and speaking with lots of people about it and writing about it. So I think it'd probably be helpful if you could speak for a while. We could speak together about about your concept, your emerging concept and ideas about a world spirituality, and then maybe together we could tease out a fundamental distinction, if there is one, ultimately, between evolutionary spirituality and world spirituality, and or where the places that they meet and where do they separate?
Wonderful. That's a wonderful model. And let me just share with everyone, you know, just kind of picking up on the model that Andrew just suggested. This kind of conversation that you're listening to, in and of itself, is an extremely rare conversation. You know, it kind of feels, I was saying to our colleague and friend the other day, Andrew Ken, it kind of feels like we're in, you know, Vienna, you know, with Freud and Ronk and, you know, a Jung, and, you know, as they were kind of launching psychology and they kind of each knew that there was something important happening, you know, there's places where the source code of the Dharma opens up. You know, and you feel like there's this great conversation that you feel unbelievably privileged to partake in, and where the point of the conversation is completely evolved beyond ego. You know, it has nothing to do with kind of the academic conversation where everyone's staking a position and, you know, moving for tenure. That we're actually in this place of really trying to clarify the Dharma. you know, looking for the deepest, you know, truth and vision, the deepest understanding, which is why it's always delightful to talk to you, because I always wind up wiser at the end of the talk than the beginning, and there's always something, you know, which is sharpening. So I'm excited for the conversation.
Well,
so let me begin.
Well, thank you for that. But just to add to what you just said, it's also not just clarifying it, but it's also we're bringing the Dharma forward. We're you know, recontextualizing the Dharma in relation, you know, relationship to the life conditions we're living in. And we're also beginning to reinterpret it and bring new insights to the Dharma itself. So this kind of conversation and in engaging together like this is really helping to redefine, you know, perennial truths.
Yes.
Which has great historical significance, at least assuming that we know what we're talking about.
No, it is, and you know, and I think you're correct that I touched it gently, because the full, you know, when I think of the full responsibility inherent in such a conversation, you know, it's almost overwhelming, and you shudder both with joy and delight, you know, at the same time, at the kind of just great privilege to be in a conversation that you're correct, not only clarifies, but just to participate in evolving the Dharma is beyond what can even imagine as a life privilege. So stepping in. So let me begin with, you know, by way of kind of understanding, who does world spirituality speak to? That's perhaps a good way to start. And I would say that world spirituality, and at any time, after any point, you know, as we always do when we dialogue, you know, you'll jump in and move the direction you move, and we'll unfold as we do. So here we go. Enough with the preliminaries. So I would say world spirituality addresses four kinds of people, which is just helpful in terms of answering the who question. And if we could kind of talk today about, you know, the who, you know, who are we talking to? You know, what is it? You know, what are we saying? How? You know, how does it work? What are the practices? What are the rituals? Why? You know, why is it, you know, critical today, and why is it necessary today? Right? You know, those questions, we could hit those, that would be awesome. So let me start with the who. The who is four types of people. Now, the first type of person is the person who doesn't locate themselves in a great tradition. And they don't locate themselves in a great tradition because they've internalized the modern and the postmodern critiques of religion. They may not even fully know what those critiques are, but they kind of live in them, they've internalized them, they're part of their kind of very fabric, their very source code, and yet they're drawn to spirit, they're moved by spirit, they're engaged in spirit, you know, and they are confused. They're not sure where to go. You know, our colleague Tammy Simon said to me, you know, from Sounds True, when Sounds True came on board for the first time in its history, you know, as a co-sponsor of World Spirituality, Tammy said something very, very telling. She said, you know, I mean, you know, laughingly, she said, I've got to atone for Sounds True, because after all, I send people every week a different system to live by. Right? You know,
right.
What are people supposed to do? They're completely confused. So Sounds True is an example of a population which is moved by spirit, and yet, you know, what do? You're completely confused by this potpourri, you know, the Jewish term, the smorgasbord, you know, the bar mitzvah of just an incredible amount of different and various foods, and there's no way you can actually integrate them into a life. So to that group, world spirituality needs to offer not a world religion, clearly not that, it's not Baha'i, right, but a world framework. You know, Charles Taylor said we live in inescapable frameworks, right? A world framework by which a person can organize, right, their spiritual intuition and their spiritual practice and kind of know that there are certain things that, you know, you need to be covering, right? There's certain bases you need to address. There's certain kind of practices that need to be, you know, part of your system. So that's group one. Group two, right, would be the people that are still living in a great tradition, still committed to a great tradition, that actually have a lot of what, you know, our spiral dynamics friends would call blue, you know, mythic consciousness in them. Right? They're living on the inside of a great tradition, and yet they don't feel that the great tradition exhausts them. It doesn't exhaust their identity. But I'm not merely Catholic in the way that a Catholic might have been 200 years ago. I'm not, you know, it's not, you know, as I grew up with my father saying, you know, what's good for the Jews is good for the world, right? That kind of ethnocentric identity, is it good for the Jews, right? Now, the second group of people are not in that place. Their identity is not exhausted, right, by their ethnocentric, right, mythic consciousness, gorgeous religion, right? Yet they're deeply inspired by it and deeply living in it, and they want to be part of something larger, and that is, we've already mentioned in passing in our earlier conversations, that second group of people, world spirituality offers the possibility of what I'm calling dual citizenship. I can be a dual citizen. I can be part of a world spirituality, that I can be a member of this kind of global unfolding and yet passionately committed in this dual relationship to my particular tradition, and the two can be mutually fructifying and evolving. Now, let me add something to that, which Ken and I have been talking a lot about the last literally 4 or 5 weeks. That what we're realizing is that actually dual citizen is the enactment of what Ken likes to call the conveyor belt. And let me just say a word about that, that's something that we're just...
That makes sense. That makes a lot
of sense. Yeah, it's nice. You know, it's just kind of occurred to both of us almost like in the same instant, you know, in a conversation, in a dialogue. So let me just say a word about the conveyor belt, because as you know, you know, it's one of the ideas that's out there that's a little understood even in integral and evolutionary circles. So when we say conveyor belt, what we basically mean, right, as Andrew knows very well, we mean that when I experience Jesus, or when I experience the Old Testament, or when I experience, you know, Muhammad, I can experience it, right, at whatever level of consciousness I am. Not only can I, it's the only way I can experience it. So if I'm at a red level of consciousness, I get a red Jesus, right? Red meaning, you know, power-driven, you know, Plato's Republic, Thrasymachus, you know, might makes right, it's a power-driven system, right? Then Jesus appears through those power-driven lens, right? If I'm at a, you know, blue level of consciousness, in a kind of mythic, right, ethnocentric consciousness, as Jesus himself probably was, according to the best scholarship, then I view Jesus as taking care of the Christians, right? And if I'm kind of this, you know, world-centric, more universal kind of person, right, then Jesus becomes the inspiration for my world-centric, right, initiatives, right, in this world. And if I'm cosmocentric, right, meaning that I'm awakened, I care for all sentient beings, and I have evolutionary integrity beyond a particular generation, but I hold the responsibility backwards and forwards in time, right, then Jesus, right, holds that, and I might turn more to the Gospel of Thomas or to particular strains of Jesus that hold that consciousness. So why is that relevant? Like, who cares? Well, we care about that for a very particular reason. Because people are profoundly influenced by their religion, right, if they receive from their religion, right, a teaching and a dharma, which naturally reflects, right, a particular level of consciousness, they'll integrate that level of consciousness and it'll become part of who they are. So if a person is at, let's say, blue consciousness, right, and they're receiving from their teacher's blue religion, they'll stay at blue. But if they stay in their religion, I stay in Christianity, and then I find another teacher who's teaching me, let me make it really concrete and real now, because everyone I asked, even, you know, my close students, I said, explain to me the conveyor belt, no one could really explain it. So this is how it works, right? So I'm blue, I'm being taught blue Jesus. Then I meet a new teacher. And that teacher is teaching me the same text in Luke 15. But then they interpret that text differently, right, through, let's say, orange or green values, which are more rational or pluralistic values. And I hear the text. My heart is open to the text. I'm in that source code of the text. It speaks to me. It bypasses my resistances. And by hearing the text explained to me based on a level of consciousness that's green, my own level of consciousness actually up-levels. I mean, that is, as you know so well, Andrew, that's the conveyor belt in a word.
And clearly, just I think I can add just add a little bit to that, and also because I think if one is at a traditional has embraced a traditional worldview, if one believes and trusts wholeheartedly and unconditionally. In the source of that traditional worldview, whether it's, you know, a Muslim, Jewish, or Christian, or whatever it is, if one is introduced to perspectives that come from a higher stage of development, you know, through the voice of that tradition, then one will be receptive to it.
Whereas
if it was coming from outside that tradition, one wouldn't be receptive, because there's going to be an inherent trust that there is a hierarchical belief that the tradition knows what the truth is. So if through the voice of the tradition and if the leaders of the particular tradition, who become the vocal cords of that particular tradition, begin to express, you know, perspectives and ways of seeing that comes from higher stages and higher levels of development, it will be embraced and accepted as being kosher, as being acceptable, And I think that's also part of what the conveyor belt concept, I think, that Ken came up with means.
Yeah, no, precisely. No, I think that's exactly right. And I think we're touching it, you know, in different language, but we're touching the same essential principle. I think that's, and that's why it's so powerful, which of course means, picking up from, you know, the way Andrew and I described that, that's precisely now what it means when we say that dual citizenship is the enactment of the conveyor belt. Right? Simply because a dual citizen is actively practicing the rituals, engaging the texts of a tradition, and is living in the source code of that tradition. Once that's no longer the case, once we have an alienation from the tradition, clearly the conveyor belt can't be affected because I'm no longer moved by the languages of that tradition. So let me just try and make that real for a second for people. So just give a very particular example. Give just maybe two very, very, very short examples. So you have a word in the book of Leviticus, right, which describes Yom Kippur, right? You and I grew up with some awareness, Andrew, of Yom Kippur. We came from different parts in the Jewish world, but Yom, holiest day of the year. So the word that describes that day is to be Lifnei Adonai, before God. So before God means God's there. I'm bowing here, you know, and I'm worshiping God, which is beautiful and wonderful. However, if you go deeper into the word, you realize that the word Lifnei, before, has two other meanings. It means face, panim, means face, and it means interiority, pnimi, interiority. And actually, if you reread the word, you realize that the word actually means, not in a kind of semantic play, but in its core meaning, Lifnei Adonai means, not quite before God, means to be on the inside of God's face. So all of a sudden, we've moved from a dual, classical, mythic relationship to the divine, I'm before God, and I need to be obedient in worship, to a second relationship where I enter into the inside of God's face, and then I realize that panim, right, face, is the expression of awakened authenticity, or awakened originality, or awakened uniqueness. Another one of our conversations that we don't need to go down that rabbit hole right now. But so my uniqueness, my authenticity, my face, is that which allows me to enter into, right, the inside of God's face, and all of a sudden I'm in a kind of completely different kind of experience, but I've been invited to it by a hermeneutic unfolding of the tradition. So instead of saying to someone, move from duality to non-duality, right, in terms of your awakened state, and clearly, by the way, I'm talking here about waking up, not growing up. I've moved from levels of consciousness, right, to waking up. But I wake up through what? Well, through realizing that the tradition is inviting me to be not only mythic, but to also be kind of in a deep non-dual awareness. So that's one way to show, right, how a hermeneutic move. Now, I know this because I've done this for 25 years. And it's the way I've tried to evolve, right, my students when I was teaching in that mythic consciousness state was never to say things. I would never make a statement. I'd always engage in a hermeneutic. I'd always take a classical text and evolve the text. And here's just the last example. Love your neighbor as yourself. So when you read love your neighbor as yourself, which is in Matthew 5:22, but originally from Leviticus 19. So you read love your neighbor as yourself. I'll tell you something completely wild, Andrew. If you look at the bottom of the page of a classical Bible, there's like 8 major commentaries, and 6 or 7 of them will tell you, and your neighbor is the one who is your neighbor in Torah and commandments, meaning the entire Jewish community. Right? Love your neighbor as yourself means all of the Jewish community, right? Which is, of course, an ethnocentric reading. But if you actually stay in the text and you actually take the word neighbor and you check it in the Bible, and then you realize, oh, the word neighbor is also used to describe Egyptians in Exodus chapter 4. And then you rewrite and say your neighbor is not only, right, one who is part of your community, but your neighbor is, as this word is used in Exodus, refers even to those who are outside of your community and even particularly to those outside of your community, and you adduce hermeneutic sources for it, and then you explain why that's important. Then you've actually shifted from ethnocentric to world-centric consciousness through an internal hermeneutic move, which is really how the conveyor belt works. I mean, just to give people a very practical example, you're actually working within a text, you're working within a tradition, and then you're evolving consciousness through the medium of that text. Now, of course, and I'll throw this open, you know, there's two ways to read what's happening here. And Andrew, you and I have occasionally talked about this. One is that you're just reading into the text. The text is really just a tool for something that's happening that really has nothing to do with the text. From a mystical perspective, you're more than reading into the text. The text is alive. I kind of remember Sound of Music, the hills are alive. Ah! So the text is alive. The text is completely alive. It's a living, breathing, non-dual realization of divinity, and the text is evolving. Right? Now that's actually the internal understanding of Hebrew mysticism, is that the text itself is supposed to evolve, and a text that remains static is called the corpse, right, in Hebrew mysticism. It's the corpse text. So this is an example of how the conveyor belt works, and naturally then dual citizen becomes an enactment of the conveyor belt, right, because you need to be engaging the text. And in world spirituality, to bring us back to our focus point, the conveyor belt and the enactment through dual citizenship remains extremely, extremely important, so that world spirituality, in its second group, its second target population, would speak the languages, like, of the classical text, whether that be Kashmir Shaivism or Buddhism or Judaism or Taoism, etc., right, at least to this population, while to the first population, it might speak a language which doesn't use the text. And it seems to me that this is one of the places that it's, at least its methodology, right, is contrasted with evolutionary spirituality, where in evolutionary spirituality, right, you're not as concerned with engaging the primary texts and rituals of the traditions themselves in this enactment dual citizen conveyor belt way. Does that sound like a fair comparison contrast?
Well, I think it does in relationship to how I teach, interpret, and understand evolutionary spirituality. I know that evolutionary spirituality at this point is being, you know, the word evolution is being used by a lot of spiritual teachers to mean all kinds of things.
Right.
And this may be part of another conversation or a larger conversation, and maybe a small part of this one, but I think what that word means, I think, needs some unpacking in general, because one of the things I've noticed is that it has become a very popular catch-all phrase for a kind of new way to speak about spirit, a new way to speak about mysticism, a new way to speak about religion, a new way to speak about interiority. But I the majority of people, not in every single case, but most of the time, I find when spiritual teachers especially are beginning to use this label, they're using it as kind of a meta context to speak about spirituality, to speak about enlightenment. But often if I continue to listen to what they're saying, when they actually speak about their dharma and their teachings, they're usually speaking about what they have been speaking about for the last, you know, 10, 20, or 30 years, or however long they've been teaching, and now they've been wrapping up in a new blanket. But when you open up the blanket, what's actually in there is what was already there before they actually had even discovered what evolutionary spirituality was, or even what evolution was. And so in that case,
right.
I realized that they still have a very superficial grasp of what evolution actually means, and then in most cases, obviously not in every case, but in most cases, evolution and the significance and the meaning and actually the experience of evolution has not yet become internalized. So it's not really part of their own internal experience, and until it becomes deeply and profoundly internalized, it can't really be a pre-conscious, a soul level or spiritual reference point. In other words, I think that when I'm speaking about evolutionary spirituality, and of course the evolutionary impulse and awakening to the evolutionary impulse that it is its source, I'm speaking about a pretty high level of spiritual attainment, where the awakening to the evolutionary impulse itself has become internalized at a preconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
The one is before thought. Aware of a telos of a reaching towards the future, and that is it's a very recently emergent spiritual phenomenon, and I think most people are more familiar with the ideas than they are with actually the experience. But that being said, I think that the way I teach evolutionary spirituality is quite radical, you know, compared to the way most people are speaking about it. And I think it very much, I think the way you were just describing it speaks truthfully to that distinction that I personally make. But I think if we're going to talk about it, we say, well, you know, I'm speaking, when I speak about evolutionary spirituality, I'm speaking about my own particular interpretation of it, which I think, just to be fair and honest to everybody, is not obviously the way everybody who teaches evolutionary spirituality would necessarily do it or would necessarily agree. But that being said, yes.
There we have your unique self again, Andrew. It just always comes up.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. As I said before, touche, and that's true.
I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. No, I actually enjoyed it. Makes me feel good. When I interpret evolutionary spirituality in the way that I do and the way that I teach it that I do, the distinction we'd be making here from the conveyor belt concept or from the inclusive concept is that what I'm speaking about is culturally very specific. I'm talking about taking this leap from a postmodern world-centric orientation to a post-postmodern, which has yet to be defined what that actually means. It doesn't exist yet.
Right.
To a post-postmodern cosmocentric orientation. And so before, when we were speaking about world-centric, a world-centric consciousness emerges, as far as I understand it, when a human being's consciousness has evolved in such a way that they now recognize that first and foremost and primarily they are human beings, first and foremost, who are citizens of the planet Earth, who happen to be citizens of a particular nations and particular nation, members of a particular religious tradition, members of a particular ethnic group, members of a particular family and location and all the rest of it. But in world-centric consciousness, all the other layers of one's self sense and self consciousness, including one's spiritual and or religious orientation and outlook and perspective, are contextualized within a primary recognition that first and foremost I'm a human being, and world-centric consciousness really, embraces are the universal nature of our shared humanity, which generally speaking, is pretty much the leading edge of this particular time in human history. But in a world-centric orientation is based upon, at least as I understand it, is based upon the recognition of the universal nature of our humanity, and which is obviously very profound, very significant. And so many of the problems that are facing us in our divided world would be able to be solved if so many more human beings, and especially our leaders, were able to evolve to a world-centric level of development, because then we'd actually begin to be able to work together, because we would be working together through this awareness of the universal nature of our shared humanity. But evolutionary spirituality, as I understand it and as I teach it, is based upon the awakening to a cosmocentric orientation, which I know you made the reference to all sentient beings, and I know often Ken uses that particular orientation. I think that's true, but in the way that I would interpret it, it was just slightly different, and now the highest and the deepest identification is with the evolutionary impulse itself. So that the evolutionary impulse is the energy and intelligence that created the universe. So in evolutionary spirituality, we call that God or spirit. So if we have a shared agreement that in the realm of manifestation, that the energy and intelligence that created the universe is what God is, then at this cosmocentric level of development, now the primary source of identification is no longer with sentient beings, but it is with God or spirit, in this case, as the energy and intelligence that created the universe. So now the identification, the deepest sense of identification, and when it's become internalized, it becomes pre-conscious and also, of course, conscious, is we're identifying with the cosmic aspiration to exist in
right.
time and in form, you see, and so
right.
that So this kind of awakening, this internalization of this kind of awakening, this kind of recognition, supersedes every other dimension of our of our existence. All the prior levels of our being and of our existence are now superseded by this primary or fundamental identification with the drive to become. And in the way that I teach this, in the way that I understand it, I think we spoke about this together. I think that, you know, your teaching always has been, you know, and world spirituality is an expression of a delightfully inclusive, spiritual and religious, you know, orientation that really is on one hand, it's inclusive because it's including in all the ways you were describing when you were speaking earlier, many different human beings with different kinds of orientations and backgrounds, but all who are really some who are just beginning to awaken to a postmodern worldview and orientation, and those who are also just beginning to look beyond a postmodern worldview and orientation. So there's a very big tent there, and I think it's your notion of a world spirituality is creating an organizing principle. I think that is very essential and very necessary right now. And I remember the first time that you mentioned it to me, which was something around a year ago. I kind of had a small epiphany when I realized that it was an organizing principle that was going to make it possible for a lot of people to come together in a spiritual and religious and mystical orientation to life that otherwise wouldn't be possible. And so I think it's playing a great role in a great service to many, many, many people. But in evolutionary spirituality, as I teach it, its fundamental motive, as I understand it, is to create the future. And so it's primarily and fundamentally future oriented. And it's profoundly future oriented in the sense that it's not invested in any way, shape, or form in what has already happened. Of course, this is all based upon an integral worldview, and we all know that we are all sitting, you know, the way we see the world and what makes it possible even to, you know, embrace a cosmocentric evolutionary orientation, you know, is all of history. So I'm not speaking about abandoning history in any way, shape, or form. I'm just trying to convey that there's an orientation that is always only interested in what's possible, right? And that which has not happened yet, but it's only interested in emergence of what could possibly occur. But that which could possibly occur would always be that which has not yet happened, that which has not yet emerged. So there's a very specific focus in evolutionary spirituality as I teach it, which is always in the possible. And therefore, in this particular orientation, whatever has already emerged, even if it is something that had never existed before, but it emerged yesterday, right? Yesterday it had never existed before. That's pretty new by any shape or sense of the imagination. The day after, this awareness, this eros driven drive would be reaching toward that which had not yet occurred. So the primary orientation here is fundamentally future oriented. And I think I think that's the distinction here. So I can give you a practical example with, for example, I think one of my students who Ruti, who was a very sophisticated woman. She's a psychoanalyst, a very sophisticated Israeli. Right. And she's been a student of mine for many years now, but she would come on some of my longer retreats and I could see that she was still, understandably, you know, she was still very identified with her her ethnocentric roots, her Jewish traditional identity, and also her national identity as being an Israeli. She was very identified with the story of Israel because that's where she grew up. You know, she has a very deep identification with the reasons why Israel was created as a nation.
Right.
And of course, being Jewish, I'm not unsympathetic. I'm sympathetic because I have Jewish blood running through my veins, and I also have ethnocentric feelings in relationship to my own tradition also. But I'm more identified with the evolutionary impulse than I am with my Jewish identity. And I was aware that because she was so still identified with her traditional identity of being a Jew and her ethnocentric and traditional identity as being a Jew, and her nationalistic sense of being an Israeli and everything that that means, it was making it difficult, if not almost impossible, for her to experience the thrill, the ecstatic thrill of the evolutionary impulse. And I explained to her, I said, look, Ruth, you're going to have to make a decision at a certain point in your life, you know, what's more important to you. I said, because, you know, there is an Israeli predicament, there's an evolutionary predicament, there's an evolutionary predicament in Israel, and there's also, there's a very real cultural problems, and there's also real challenges that the nation is facing. And I think you're going to have to make up your mind, you know, in this life, you know, now you're, let's say you're, she's around my age or a little bit older, I'm 55, mm-hmm. maybe she's my age or a little bit older, I say, you're going to have to make up your mind at this particular point, what's more important to you, you know, the evolution of consciousness and culture at the leading edge, or these particular dimensions of your own experience as you relate to this Israeli-Jewish predicament. You know, we have to make a decision because we all only have so long to live this particular life.
Right.
And it took her about 5 years, 6, 7, 8 years, to actually really understand what I meant. And then I think around 2 years ago, she started seeing our objective, making subject object, and really seeing that she was going to have to make a choice. And finally, she was saying, she could see that she was letting go of a lot of the way she was identified with being Israeli, and kept saying, I don't care about any of these things anymore. What I'm interested in is creating the future in a very different way, in a way that's free from that particular historical, personal, historical, you know, cultural, ethnocentric, religious, etc. agenda. And then she could actually begin to experience the thrill of everything that at least my teaching represents and what evolutionary spirituality in the form that I teach it, which is a particular kind of thrill, a particular kind of spiritually inspired thrill of, it's an unbelievable thrill and excitement about being alive because we actually do realize what's possible and what we want to do from that perspective. And I have to be very honest, it's not that many people that are actually go far enough to really be able to embody what I'm speaking about because it is so far out ahead at the edge. But it's the thrill of being unencumbered, you know, the thrill of being unencumbered by what has been so one can be completely, utterly, totally, and radically available for what is possible. So it's very exclusive, you know, in that way, and I don't see evolutionary spirituality in the way that I'm expressing it and interpreting it as being a universal path, but I see it as being a path for particular kinds of human beings at particular points in their own evolution when they realize there's a certain function that needs to be served by people at the very, very edge that's absolutely and only future oriented, and there are people that need to be doing that particular work, and so the evolutionary orientation and spirituality that I'm teaching serves that particular function, and I recognize it's not universal. It's only for a particular group of people, and therefore it's not inclusive, it's exclusive. But it serves a very significant and important role, I think, for everybody.
Right, and
that would be the kind of distinction, but once again, just to be clear, and I know I've said this a few times, but this is how I this is my particular interpretation of it, and I know there's lots of people that are teaching evolutionary spirituality which certainly would not approach it in such a in such a particularly exclusive, which could be, some people could feel that it was kind of narrow, because often sometimes when I'm teaching, people say, well, what about everybody else? And I say, well, this path isn't for everybody. This serves a particular function. There's culturally, you know, there is a vacuum now in our shared cultural evolution at the very edge, that most of us, you know, the structures that have held our shared culture together have crumbled, and most very sensitive, very sophisticated people have no idea how to make sense out of the human experience anymore. You know, very educated, very sophisticated, very sensitive people are very lost, because they don't, because there are shared, because there, the shared values that really hold culture together are, have become very ambiguous.
Right.
And so, as you yourself, Mark, know, because of the time you lived in Israel, we also know that many people, for example, grow up in a postmodern context, realize that it's based on, you know, narcissism and materialism,
yeah,
and relative, you know, relativism. And so that to find a source of meaning and purpose, they go back, instead of moving forward, understandingly, they go back and then embrace a traditional worldview. And through doing it, they experience what I call spiritual self-confidence. You know, they discover spiritual self-confidence. They embrace values that make meaning out of life and discover a rootedness and a centeredness, you know, which changes everything. And my only problem with that is that the world that we're living in, you know, we're living in a modern and postmodern world that is rapidly moving towards the future at a very fast rate. And the problem with a traditional worldview is it doesn't embrace so many of the realities of the modern and postmodern world we're living in. So it's actually denying so much of what is actually real. And unless our religion, unless our spirituality is enabled to embrace the totality of reality and the totality of the world that we're living in, it won't be one that I feel that's sufficient to embrace the world we're living in. It won't be able to empower us, to spiritually empower us, to respond wholeheartedly, you know, in a way that we are spiritually empowered. It won't spiritually empower us to respond to the world we're living in the most appropriate way. So I feel that our religious and spiritual orientation must be one that's able to embrace the totality of the life conditions that we're living in, so we will then become spiritually empowered to respond. Yeah.
Beautiful. No, beautiful. I mean, that's a gorgeous, you know, dharmic flow, and I was just delighted to receive it. And just to answer everyone's question, you know, the implicit question on the phone, the only way that Andrew and I can unpack this is actually not by going back and forth very quickly, because to unpack the depth of what Andrew did, you actually need kind of space, which is why, although there were many points we could have gone back and forth there, the delight of this is that we're not on television, we're not going for ratings, we're actually in the Dharmic source code and trying to kind of really listen deeply. So it's very important to have kind of long stretches where you can really unfold a Dharma, you know, in a deep way and kind of really follow its code. So that's what Andrew just did so gorgeously. So what I'd like to do is, I think that's a great way to kind of, by putting that on the table, let me try and kind of outline where are the places where there's really deep, profound shared language, and where, as you beautifully pointed to, where is there a different orientation, which is, and difference is good. You know, there's many instruments in a symphony, and from their diversity emerges music. You know, a body's 50 trillion cells, which are all, you know, unique, yet in profound communion. And so to kind of, paradoxically, the way that we can actually create a kind of larger integrity, a larger kind of symphonic resonance, you know, in the unfolding of spirit between evolution and world spirituality, is not only to show where they share language, but also to show their diversity, because it's precisely, you know, the puzzle piece contours of the puzzle piece that allow us to fit into the larger one. So with that in mind, let me just try and kind of go a couple of steps here. So first, when we talk about a world-centric or a cosmocentric orientation, right, within the context of world spirituality, as when you and Ken and I had that delightful talk on the phone, right, let me make the following distinction, right? From the perspective of where we're sitting, there's absolutely no question that the fundamental orientation of world spirituality is cosmocentric, and at the same time, right, it's a larger tent. And as you correctly point out, and let me point to what that might mean. So, number one, every system, right, every moment in consciousness, right, orients according to, you know, I referred to earlier what Taylor calls inescapable frameworks, or what we might call the myth, right? What's the myth? Right? And when we say myth, of course, you know, we of course, as we both use it, we're not talking about, you know, myth with a small m, myth with a large m. I mean, what's the most evolved understanding of consciousness as we understand it when we weave together, right, the different dots of our knowing, we connect the dots, and that larger vision of knowing produces, right, a great myth by which we orient ourselves. So, for example, the orientation to the future, right, the kind of resoundingly, you know, positive affirmation of life, right, implicit or inherent and explicit, and evolutionary spirituality, right, unencumbered, right, from the past, not invested in what has already happened, right, that's part of an orienting myth that actually, again, myth in the largest, most deep and profound sense, and myth being more real than real, not less real than real, right, that's part of that myth. So world spirituality has to decide what is its myth, right, meaning it has to kind of go inside based on, you know, the whatever level of consciousness or realization, right, you know, its formulators, you know, might have or have access to, that's to kind of decide what's its North Star, where's it going. And in that sense, it's very, very important to kind of say clearly that world spirituality is unresoundingly cosmocentric, right, in the sense that it experiences itself as being evolutionary, right, in its most essential sense, and at having moved, if I can borrow a phrase from the great traditions, because, and again, one can even hear in the different way that we speak, right, actually the difference in the tenor of things. So I'll always refer back to the great traditions, then kind of move at a stage forward. So in the great traditions, the basic move is to move from mitzidenu to mitzido, to move from our perspective to the divine perspective. Right? And in the kind of, in the esoteric, deep understanding of the great tradition, that's the essential move of a human being. I've actually shifted perspective. My teacher, Chaim of Elezion, who was kind of the lineage master in my, you know, one of my two major lineages, that's this entire major book called The Soul of Life, in section four is about how you make this move from your perspective to God's perspective. So that's the essential cosmocentric orientation, which creates in its wake an enormous sense of responsibility. And, right, as he cites, as Chaim Velez and the other teachers cite, when you read the Zohar, right, one particular mystical Hebrew text today, whatever it says today, when you read that text, it doesn't say it tomorrow. Because yesterday's interpretation is actually not relevant. It was yesterday's interpretation in Bereshit Bara Elohim, in the beginning, we create God. Now, here's the paradox, though. So that's a profoundly cosmocentric orientation, living, right, in a great tradition, right, which we then pick up on and evolve in the context, right, of a world spirituality, whose essential North Star, whose essential myth, right, is cosmocentric, and therefore the leading edge of a world spirituality needs to be cosmocentric. And in that sense, I think that's what Ken meant when we were on the phone. I think that world spirituality at its leading edge includes, right, or is almost identical with, right, an evolutionary spirituality of the leading edge variety, of the beautiful, gorgeous variety that you just described, making the important distinction between, you know, the so many other varieties, which are lovely, but I use the word lovely carefully, but seem to be just the same old teaching with a label on top. Okay, so yes. Now, having said that, so where's the distinction? So I think where the distinction lies is that a world spirituality, in some sense, seeks to operate not as a world religion in any way, but with the same hermeneutic shakti, with the same modular, scalable, internal, organismic eros, right, of the great religions. And what I mean by that is as follows, right? The paradox of a great religion, right? And again, not anything goes there. A great religion, I mean, you know, which has profound, you know, lineage sources, which has profound texts, which has awakened realization in its leading masters, which has a body of practitioners who have been creating, you know, for a couple of thousand years, a profound morphic resonance in the fields of consciousness, right, which has been transformed with an evolutionary, right? The nature of a great tradition is that it can be interpreted on many levels. That's actually one of its demarcating characteristics, that its strength is that the villager, right, in South India, you know, the householder in Kansas is able to access and live something in that great religion, which is different, you know, than, let's say, in Christianity, than the esoteric Jesuit, right, who's living, you know, a non-dual evolutionary realization based on his particular leading-edge interpretation, right, of Jesus, but which actually emerges from his depth of consciousness in which he actually is identified in some profound way with the emergence of Tamar that lives in today. Right? Those two people are both viewing themselves as Christian, right? And yet, and they're both under that same large tent, and yet their internal consciousness, right, is profoundly different. And paradoxically, the strength of a great religion is that it allows for that tent. Right? That's its particular strength. And if I would say what the essential challenge of a world spirituality today is to, on the one hand, not become a religion. We don't need another world religion, right? It's not going to work for all sorts of pragmatic reasons, and it's unnecessary, right? We want to allow for the diversity, because that's what is. When we allow for it, meaning we recognize what is, right, number one. But number two, we're able to create a kind of mythic framework in which the leading edge, right, is this cosmocentric evolutionary initiating energy of the divine living in us, as us, and through us, and taking full responsibility for all that is, right, living in this kind of non-dual awakened realization in which I understand that I'm not merely before God, but I'm on the inside of God's face, right, as we talked about earlier. And at the same time, right, world spirituality is a framework which allows for the conveyor belt, right? As world spirituality is a framework in which a person can be a dual citizen, right, moving up the conveyor belt, up levels of consciousness, and a person can locate themselves, right, in a world spirituality, even if they haven't reached that leading edge of consciousness, which is represented by the cosmocentric apex, right, of a world spirituality. And in that sense,
you know, just listening to, I don't mean to interrupt, but I guess I did now.
but I did anyways.
But
go ahead, please.
No, when I'm hearing you speak about, the world spirituality, I think that if you could, for example, if you could come up with, for example, a Christian, a Muslim, etc.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, like one representative of each of the great traditions, you know, who,
right,
at least to your satisfaction, lived up to, or you know, the high level of spiritual development and attainment that you were just describing, then obviously that would be a pretty significant challenge to find individuals who were representatives of all the great traditions, who were, you know, as, you know, who are as spiritually enlightened and as evolutionarily informed.
Mm-hmm.
Because you'd have to have individuals who were spiritually
enlightened. Yeah, absolutely.
Spiritually enlightened, integrally informed, and evolutionary,
right,
enlightened, all in the same room, and then also have maybe a representative of one or two forms of postmodern spirituality. You know, postmodern spirituality, it's in its very shapes and forms of variety, who are also integrally informed and evolutionarily.
Yes.
Awake, and then if you could then like to have a circle then of those individuals, and then really to begin the discussion based on a lot of the you know, quite sophisticated principles that you've been speaking about in relationship to evolutionary spirituality, and then in relationship to all these different traditions, because, you know, many people say, oh well, ultimately all the traditions are the same, and I don't really think it's quite that simple. There are fundamental distinctions between,
absolutely, absolutely,
and it's not really all the same. It's
not all the same at all. No, it's not all the same.
But within the context of this big tent,
mm-hmm,
but it's a high tent.
A high tent. In the tent, there's a high tent, right? In other words, there's a larger tent. But in other words, in every great tradition, there was always, right, Andrew, there was the esoteric essence of the tradition.
Yes, certainly, yes.
Right? And then there was the exoteric. So in world spirituality, what I'm suggesting is that world spirituality, and this is something that I wasn't able to say to you clearly 6 months ago, because as we said then, we're really in the source code evolving it. What we're now beginning to understand is that world spirituality paradoxically models itself from a kind of Shakti, awakened, enlightened perspective, right, on the actual model of a great religion, in which the great religion itself is modular, right? Right.
I get that idea, but I'm just trying to offer. I'm offering. This is just something that came to my mind as I heard you speak.
Right.
I'm just offering it to you as a friend, just as an idea. In other words, I think that I think that, to be totally honest with you, you know, I'm being honest with you in public. It was just for fun. No, I think that you would be hard-pressed, you mean to be totally frank, to find a representative of all the great traditions who were in their own right spiritually enlightened, who are also integrally informed and evolutionarily enlightened. But
so
if you could, in other words, if you could, and once again, and then I've got a couple of representatives of postmodern spirituality, if you get all
right.
Everybody together, and then you could start a process of a real working group, you know, that you could basically do in public and in private to really begin to sort out these delicate distinctions, and also begin, you know, embrace this whole process of the reinterpretation of the perennial truths of the great traditions within this new lens. And if a group like that could do it together, and spending time on all of the different traditions, you know, an equal amount of time on all the different traditions, and then comparing all in light of this kind of evolutionary tension, because you're reaching up through this, like a bubble almost. I just, like an image
right.
in my mind comes back of this big bubble coming up from the bottom of the ocean. You're trying to take everybody to a higher level of integration while also being true to their own traditions at the same time, which is quite a feat. In other words, it's one thing to talk about it, and I'm not saying you're only trying to do that, but I'm saying if you could gather such a group together and engage in such a spiritual process of intersubjective, shared, rigorous contemplation, debate, you know, study, you know, and real evolutionary tension and friction, ultimately what could come out of it could be something quite extraordinary and spectacular, which could be really, I think, the fulfillment of everything that you're so excited about. In other words, I'm saying that your vision is a great vision, and it's a noble vision, and it's an important vision, and I think it has integrity. I know you thought a lot about it since our first discussions, and I think it's very, this needs to happen. But taking this from the realm of an inspired idea to something that has real teeth, I think what I'm suggesting would make that possible, and it would be like a real spiritual ordeal or a sweat lodge, so to speak. And it would obviously and it's a process I'm sure that would take several years. But then I think if you could come out the other side, I mean, you'd come up with something that would be absolutely amazing.
Yeah, no, it was just
a spontaneous idea that came to my mind, but I mean, it would be a way to put a lot of your inspiration here, you know, which is wonderful, you know, and has a lot of your thinking has a lot of integrity to it. But if you could get a group like that together, and get a kind of commitment from everybody involved to really go through this process, you'd actually be able to come out the other side with something that would be.
I think that's
the world
completely.
Would have to listen to. In other words, no. it would be embrace each of the traditions very specifically, and then postmodern spirituality very directly. Because I know I've seen some of the inclusive groups that you come up with, they're all wonderful people, but it wouldn't have the same integrity
yep.
or create emergent power. I think
right.
is what I'm. Anyway,
yep.
it's a loving suggestion from a friend. But I
yeah, yeah totally, totally. I appreciate
the
private note.
No, I think there's something to it.
It's a fantastic suggestion, and actually, you know, I think we're in the same in this particular area, in the same, and I completely appreciate it and honor it. We're in the same quadrant of consciousness. What we're thinking of doing is, and actually, my young friend and colleague Dustin DiPerna, we just hired him. He'll be our educational director, and together with Dustin and Zach and you know, a bunch of other people. What we're going to do is actually, we'd like to launch next year what we're calling which you exactly, you know, in the beauty of your kind of sacred intuition, Andrew, you kind of hit it. We're about to launch what we're calling the 10-year conversation. And the 10-year conversation is not for the council and everyone involved, but it's for what we might call the leading edge of the council. And we basically realize that a broad council conversation, which needs to happen and will happen, but won't have the same ability to actually produce something that actually needs to be listened to. And we realize it's not a 1, 2, or even 3-year conversation. We view it as a decade-long conversation, which is, you know, much along the lines. We called it, you know, a kind of, you know, elite metasangha. You know, first off, they have to be from around the world. Because we know the postmodern context that actually language and geography, right, and historical context is influential. And so we can't have a Metasangha from San Francisco and Boston, right, which is would be an American tendency. But we need a genuine Metasangha. You know, we think of not more than perhaps 10 people, you know, which would be a lot, you know, who could actually participate in this conversation and actually try and get at a profound sense of what this vision means. But let me, yes, and yes again. But before, I want to kind of step back and then move forward, because let's kind of talk for a second about, you know, in world spirituality, what is it again at its leading edge? We said cosmocentric at its leading edge. So let me just try and say it a little differently. You know, one of the first things you asked me was, okay, is this interface? Right, which is a great question. It was a great
I remember that, and what you're speaking about definitely is not.
Right, it's definitely right. And I just want to
It's not merely.
That's exactly right. And I want to thank you as well, because, you know, our conversations, you know, and hopefully they'll go on, you know, have been, you know, part, an important part of the process of clarifying, you know, thinking, because that's what a genuine, you know, high level, you know, egoless dharmic conversation does. So, let me try and frame it, you know, more clearly. So, interfaith, as I think we said even back then, interfaith, you know, as we know its origins, interfaith was very, very important in that it allowed for respect between the religions. You know, and you know, that's no small deal, you know, and as for a Jew living in the Middle Ages, a little respect from the Christian neighbors was a big deal. It meant that you weren't going to be massacred. So let's not belittle that. You know, we just need to read, you know, kind of accounts of, you know, brutal atrocities and the 7 genocides, right, in the 20th century, you know, documented by Samantha Power in her book, A Problem from Hell, and know the roles that, you know, power and religion both play in them. So respect and civility, you know, let's not, you know, we both understand that's huge. Right, respect and civility is huge. And, you know, it can't produce actually a shared language of profound consciousness, right, in which we actually go deep into the source code and understand from an evolutionary perspective how do we engage tomorrow, because, you know, the inception of interfaith was basically, in a certain sense, liberal Jews who didn't believe in Judaism, who got together with liberal Protestants who didn't believe in Christianity, and then they discovered they had a lot in common, right? It was a great gathering. But on neither side were the people in the source code. They weren't in the source code. They weren't committed to the source code. They weren't obligated to the source code. And, right, they weren't operating with any kind of evolutionary perspective. So that's kind of one. Two, let's take a look at perennial philosophy. Right, you know, world spirituality is not perennial philosophy. Because perennial philosophy, right, is essentially a regressive move. It's a beautiful regressive move, but it's regressive. It's regressive in the sense that perennial philosophy will distinguish between surface structures and depth structures, and we'll point towards, as Fritz F. Schuon calls, the transcendent unity of religions, but it's the transcendent unity of the pre-modern realization of the great religions. So to basically, right, embrace a pre-modern realization, right, as we're moving so rapidly, as you say, every day into the future, right, where the future, where every day is so obviously pregnant with tomorrow, would actually be make a regressive move, right? So and to embrace perennial philosophy today would be regressive, paradoxically, right? And all the great champions of perennialism kind of forget that issue. So we need to, on the one hand, receive the perennial wisdom, you know, on which, you know, Ken and myself and you, Andrew, at different times, we cut our teeth and were greatly influenced by and appreciated, you know, the download from Fritz F. Schuon, you know, to Houston Smith, to Aldous Huxley, you know, to that great group of people who all, you know, shared something important. But we need actually not the best of pre-modern, but a world spirituality has to be, right, the best of pre-modern, modern, and post-modern. Right, the best of pre-modern, modern, and post-modern insights, which yields, right, something we don't yet know yet. Right, and so when we talk about enlightenment, we can't have a classical enlightenment, and in a certain sense, what binds us in Dharma is both through complete different roots, right, you know, whether through internally, externally, study, realization, whatever the processes were, right, realize that the old enlightenment story is critical, but insufficient. And that's precisely what a world spirituality would say, that the old enlightenment story is pre-modern. And therefore, right, a new enlightenment story has to take into account the best of pre-modern, modern, and post-modern, which would include neuroscience, right, which would include, right, a deep understanding of the evolutionary context, right, which would include, right, you know, a kind of perennialism rooted in a post-metaphysical evolutionary trajectory, right? So that would be a vision of world spirituality. And at the same time, world spirituality wants to create a tent, right, which allows for many paths, right, to living a life, right, which is meaningful, and to actually refabricating the world, right, with a story that's compelling. Because we live in a destoried universe, right? I mean, postmodernity was the undermining of any grand narrative, right? It was the embrace of all uncertainty. And it was the embrace of uncertainty because the religions had overreached and claimed too much certainty, and then science overreached and claimed too much certainty. So postmodernism kind of rejected both of them and said there is no grand narrative. But the paradox of postmodernism was that the only grand narrative that postmodernism did have is that there's no grand narrative, meaning that there's no story. So it basically undermined the ability, right, to create a meaningful context, right, for the largest tent that we can, for people to actually live in a context which has a story, which has a trajectory, which has a telos, right, which has a direction, right, which actually invests my life with infinite adequacy, dignity, meaning, and purpose and demand. So that's what a world spirituality needs to be able to do, not only for its leading edge, it needs to be able to translate it. So let me just give you an example of a translation so I can take this out of this is not abstract. This is the kind of grand vision, but kind of concretize it. So take the idea of obligation. And obligation's a critical idea. Right? An obligation is an idea, whenever I mention it in teaching, you can literally hear in the first second, if it's not my inner circle of students, it's a broad audience, you can feel the cringe in the room. Right? Because most of the people in the room spend their lives, moving beyond obligation, which they felt was imposed by parents, imposed by churches, imposed by society, and they've done 30 years of therapy or 20 years of therapy to be liberated from obligation. Right? And yet, obligation is an utterly essential, radical idea, and an unobligated human being is dead. So how do you reclaim obligation, the second tier of consciousness, right, in a language that's broadly available? So just give you an example. This is a world spirituality teaching that's literally just evolved in the past, 3 months, and I've been able to kind of say it clearly. So here's the quick image. You're with Mother Teresa on a desert island. Now, both you and I know that Mother Teresa, right, far from being a lovely and nice person, was a righteous person, but was an absolute madwoman. Right? You read her 3 biographies. I mean, she was just wildly, wildly, crazy and demanding and, and this fabulous human being. You don't create a new order in the Vatican because you're sweet. Right? So Mother Teresa says, so you're stuck on a desert island with Mother Teresa. You're never going to be saved. You know that. There's plenty of food on the island. Mother Teresa happens to like scuba diving. Let's make up our story. Okay, so she's scuba diving. She gets injured. You happen to know first aid. So you fix her up, but her hands are fully extended and they're going to be that way for 6 weeks. Plenty of food on the island. Do you have an obligation to feed her? Well, the answer is, of course you do. Of course you have an obligation to feed her. And it's a genuine obligation, the deepest Shakti sense of obligation. Well, the question is why? So the why is actually very elegant here. The why is because there's a need, right? It's an authentic need. You recognize the need and you're the only person who can fill the need. So there's this kind of fourfold notion. There's a need, right? An authentic need. You recognize the need, right? And you're the only person who can fill the need. Right? Now, that understanding creates obligation, which is precisely the awakened experience of the unique self / authentic self. And let's just use them together now for a second. Right? The awakened unique / authentic self experiences that there's a need, there's an authentic need, recognizes the need, and knows that his or her unique expression of divinity that lives in them, as them, and through them is the only thing that can contribute, right, that can save God, that can contribute to the future in a way that no one else can. Now, paradoxically, that idea that we just, articulated of a second tier, if you will, or a kind of profound level of obligation in which I actually experience myself as being obligated, and we're not going to solve human trafficking, 17 million slaves, because we're feeling philanthropic or because we're feeling charitable. We'll solve it because we feel obligated to solve it. If we can't reclaim the joy and responsibility of obligation, right, then we have no chance. And so a world spirituality, one of its jobs would be to reclaim obligation. Now, from a cosmocentric perspective, we'll understand this doctrine of 4 needs, right, in a very particular way. But it's also very valuable from a world-centric perspective. That's what I mean by a modular, right? In other words, even if you're world-centric, right, which is beautiful and holy and fantastic, but you haven't actually realized cosmocentric consciousness, which is true about the overwhelming majority of the best people on the planet. The cultural creatives are almost all, right, world-centric and are essential for unfolding, right, the next stage, right, of the world because they're in the source code and everything, right? We need to offer them a way of articulating, right, and experiencing genuine obligation. And so that would be an example, right, of a world spirituality at play, right? In other words, reclaiming obligation, right, even without, and here's a powerful thing to say, even without any kind of classical enlightened consciousness, right? Even if basically the sum total experience of the cultural creatives is that of a separate self, right, with occasional glimpses, a true self, an awakened consciousness, but basically living in the consciousness of a separate self, right, nonetheless, they're still able to identify, right, an experience of you know, unique obligation, which is the unique obligation to give my unique gifts that emerges from this doctrine of needs. And so that's what attracts me to a world spirituality. What attracts me to it is that if we can actually access the essential model of the great traditions, and this is just what I'm just understanding this in the last few months. As I'm talking to people around the world, I'm realizing something that I always knew. And whenever you have a new realization, like, I always knew this, but it just didn't hit me. I was, oh my God, that the greatness of the great traditions is that, you know, Moses de Leon writing the Zohar, right, can read the verse, you know, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and he'll read it, right, you know, correctly, not imposing upon it. He'll read it from within based on his level of consciousness, right, as a mystical epiphany to create God, which is how he reads in the first passage of the Zohar. Bereshit, in the beginning, bara, right, we create the divine, right? And, right, you know, sitting, you know, really a village away, right, in southern France in the mid-12th century, someone else will read it, right, as an external creator God creating a world in 6 days, right? And for both of them, it's going to give something, you know. To one, it's going to give a sense of meaning, right, and structure in the world in one way. And to Moses de Leon...
So world spirituality, right, is going to be able to serve the needs of individuals at traditional, modern, and postmodern levels of development.
Right.
The idea is that it would be able to be presented in such a way that it'll have different tiers of inclusion, and different levels of exoteric and esoteric interpretation.
So that
individuals at different levels of personal, cultural, and spiritual development, really their needs would be met. And at the same time, I imagine, as you've been saying, there would be inherently in it, because you said it's going to be inherently an evolutionary orientation, there would be a conveyor belt, so there would be a telotic, I suppose, there would be an inherent telos or a pull always beyond to people at all levels, including the highest level.
Right. I mean, and that's exciting.
That's exciting. Yes, very much so.
That's exciting. So in a room like these 10 people, so it's critical for you to be in the room, right, holding that postmodern emergent perspective in the particularly gorgeous way, right, you know, that you've expressed and unfolded evolutionary spirituality, because that's going to be part of what creates, you know, that sense of, you know, creative discord, right, that creative emergent discord in the room, that kind of tension that, you know, produces that next wave, right, you know, it's got to be like radically egoless, you know, and radically committed, right, and radically, you know, everyone in the room has to have kind of a radical identification with their instruments, you know. And when I use the image of a symphony, you know, the kind of progressive listening feel that it's very, very inclusive and lovely. But the people listening more deeply realize that actually in a symphony, you need to be the absolute master of your own instrument to join the symphony. You don't actually get to join the symphony by dabbling, right? You don't get to go to a bunch of New Age seminars, do a little teaching, write a couple of books, you join the symphony. You join the symphony by this radical, you know, life, you know, sacrificing commitment, right, to this higher vision of life, then you're actually playing your instrument. Then that instrument can actually create the music, right, the diversity of music that creates the world, you know, spirituality. So there's got, the core of it always has to be this kind of, you know, radical, profound commitment. And that seems to be the place where world spirituality and evolutionary spirituality, in the way that you're describing it, right, can dance, right, because they really actually are both profoundly different, yet profoundly, you know, need each other not in the egoic sense, but in the larger world emergent sense. They're dancing different movements in the dance, and yet it's clearly, right, an interwoven dance in which each one, right, is leading or following at a different time.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I just want to encourage you that if you could include in your as you're developing this thing, these representatives of the great traditions, it will really validate, at least in the eyes of many of those traditions, it will validate world spirituality, and it will validate everything that you're speaking about in ways that otherwise wouldn't be possible. In other words, if the main authors of world spirituality are not necessarily members of different traditions and religious orientations, if the authors aren't, I just don't think it'll have the same validity in the eyes of many people that it would if the architects were, you know, not completely, but largely, you know, recognized and respected and realized representatives of these different traditions.
Yeah, no, I think that
again,
I think that
if you can get a commitment like that from some from extraordinary representatives and start a process like this and really put all this, you know, really put all this to the test with those individuals, because obviously what you've been what would happen then is your own, because you're obviously very inspired by an integral perspective, and very awake and inspired by evolution. And I think then the challenge would be, well, to be sorting out these questions with other individuals from or representatives of these great traditions, and if they weren't as equally awake to an integral perspective or to the evolutionary cosmic context in which all this is happening, it would be it would be challenging to sort this out.
I wanted
to wholeheartedly encourage you to try and approach it in this way, because I think it would validate, it would give a credibility and a validation to what you're already doing in a way that would be really quite marvelous and extraordinary. And I'm sure that the creative friction between individuals from different traditions, assuming that these individuals had philosophical integrity and they were really willing to really just work, then I also think it would be amazing would be to see, well, you know, the different traditions also bring different gifts. You know, there's different different traditions.
But the unique medicine of every tradition.
Yes, exactly. And then you can see within the context of world spirituality, once there was a shared agreement, it would be beautiful to be able to emphasize the different, and you know, to use your language, the unique gifts of particular traditions, so that everybody would be able to recognize and appreciate them within the context of this larger movement. It could be quite extraordinary.
I think that's completely right. I mean, for example, you know, one of the things, you know, that Jewish Kabbalists talk a lot about is meditation, right? And actually, you know, there's an enormous amount of meditative text in Judaism. It's a great meditative tradition. Having said that, that's not the unique medicine of Judaism, right? So even though Aryeh Kaplan, who's a beautiful man, and I spoke to him at the end of his life, who wrote that first set of books that I'm sure you've come across on Jewish meditation, Kabbalistic meditation, but he went and looked for those texts, not because he was practicing them growing up. I mean, no, these were all esoteric texts. But the unique medicine of Judaism, it had to do with something else. It had to do with a living textual tradition. It had to do with a kind of commitment to ethical transformation. It was a particular set of medicines. It had to do with the law that, you know, inhered and animated the dailiness of life, etc. You know, at the same time, you know, the Buddhists, right, you know, they really spend all of their time on mind states. You know, which the particular, you know, Christianity, you know, did a lot of work on forgiveness. And again, that doesn't mean that forgiveness doesn't exist in Islam. Right, or in Jew, of course it does, and of course the source of it is the high priest, but the Christians did a lot of work on developing forgiveness, and that they have a specific kind of sacred evolved technology there, right, that might be very important, et cetera, that once we actually have a shared language, you know, the particular gift, right, is unbelievably important. Having said that, last sentence on my part in this context, we got to, and I think we'll move towards closure here, but we got to the first two types of people, and it just shows how rich this conversation was. We just got to the beginning of it, but it's a fantastic beginning. You know, I was trying to outline the four types of people that a world spirituality addresses, right? So the first type of person was the person not located in the traditions, who doesn't want to engage the traditions, right, who's not sourced in them, and who needs a language that's beyond them. So that's one kind of person. And so world spirituality will have to articulate a framework, right, not only drawing from the traditions, but which allows a person who's beyond the traditions to feel, right, I'm a citizen of a global spirituality, and that's where the kind of evolutionary context is, you know, is absolutely essential, right, at this place. Now,
evolutionary context and also an integral worldview would
and an integral worldview 1,000%.
Such an individual, yeah.
Absolutely, and among this large group of people, there'll also be, you know, modular levels of consciousness. There'll be people who will actually be able to integrate a cosmocentric evolutionary worldview, which is integrally informed, and there'll be people who won't. There'll be people who will, however, pick up on, let's say, the fourfold doctrine of obligation that we just outlined, and will experience themselves as obligated, right, and ethically compelled, right, and will be able to create a framework of obligation and ethical expression and meaning for themselves and their children, right, not from this awakened cosmocentric state, and world spirituality has a responsibility to both languages. At the same time, the second group of people, which is the dual citizens, right, the dual citizens who are kind of the enactment of the conveyor belt, in order for that to happen, we need, which is essentially what we're describing here, you know, creatively together, we need a kind of, you know, a kind of meta-sangha of, you know, 10 leading-edge dual citizens, right, who will be able to hold, or whatever the number is, be able to hold the most enlightened, awakened consciousness of the traditions, right?
Right.
And then speak back to the traditions in order to catalyze, right, the conveyor belt. So you need actually, in a certain sense, philosopher king dual citizens, right, who are not just casual about it, but they're awakened dual citizens who kind of will go through the whole spiral. Let me just add two more very, very, very brief things. There are two other groups that world spirituality will transform, right, but paradoxically, elliptically, right? One is people who have internalized, this is group three, they've internalized the modern and postmodern critiques of religion, and they've gone secular, right? And if they haven't, they're not getting sounds through tapes. Right, they basically said, you know, we're not interested. And they're not interested because they have a particular view of religion. Right? And someone like our dear colleague, Warren Farrell, who's gotten really involved in the Center for World Spirituality, I would say Warren, until he engaged world spirituality, fell into that category. Right? In other words, you know, he completely read and internalized the modern postmodern critiques of religion and went secular. And world spirituality is beginning to offer him a language, right, that allows him to actually re-engage, paradoxically. And then the fourth group, paradoxically, Andrew, the fourth group, the fourth typology that a world spirituality would address is actually fundamentalists, right? And I think, by the way, in the same way, I think that your evolutionary spirituality challenges fundamentalists, because basically fundamentalism dismisses kind of progressive, liberal, human potential, New Age religion as being uncommitted, you know, lacking discipline, lacking surrender, lacking depth, right, lacking caring. And
they're not completely wrong.
And they're not completely wrong at all, right? In other words, they're not completely wrong at all. As a matter of fact, you know, they're probably 98% right, right? And but they don't see in the progressive human potential world, right, a committed alternative which has, right, a level of depth and consciousness and awakened realization and commitment and willingness to surrender and to sacrifice that equals, right, their own blue system. And so they say to themselves, forget about the theological issues. I'm going to stand my church, and they've got a lot going for them there. So a genuinely committed world spirituality or evolutionary spirituality, as you present it, actually challenges the intelligent fundamentalist in the best way. So those are the four.
It's fabulous, and there's a lot to work out here. I think it's going to take. There's a lot of pieces to work out, because it's a big vision, and to embrace all these four different individuals and their particular needs. Is going to involve a lot of thinking and a lot of consideration.
I appreciate very much the conversation. I think we can at least safely say that we've come farther than we were a year ago. We've evolved.
Well, definitely. But I mean, I think a year ago you were trying to figure out what world spirituality was. I think because we spoke a little bit about it then. I think if I remember then, it was more of an intuition.
That's right. It's now beginning to kind of articulate. And Ken's been a fantastic dialogue partner, and Ken and I have been spent a lot of work on this. And our conversations, Andrew, you know, from your perspective of evolutionary spirituality, you know, we view Ken, myself, just as an integral part of the evolution, because in these conversations, every time something clarifies, you know, and that is a great and invaluable gift for which I'm.
Well, I'm happy to continue to help to talk about it and help in any way I can.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew.
And I will continue to encourage you to try and find representatives of the great traditions who could become real partners in this project with you.
Wonderful. I'll receive that encouragement. So thank you very, very much, Andrew Cohen, for being with us, and everyone. Please try and access Enlighten Next online to be able to find Andrew's teaching, Being in Becoming Retreats. He has a new book coming out. We actually both have new books coming out in September, which will be in dialogue with each other on evolutionary enlightenment. And, you know, find Andrew everywhere that you can. So, Andrew, thank you very much. Much blessing. And I'll look forward to talking after we finish this dialogue offline. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Mark. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, completely.